Brenda Nile is one of Australia's most highly acclaimed biographers. She's written lives of the writers Mary Grant Bruce and Ethel Turner, of artists Judy Kassab and Martin Boyd, of the activist Archbishop Daniel Mannix, just to name a few. But after a dozen or more books and a career as an academic, she has turned her attention to her own family, to match factories and sea journeys and rural Australian properties, in her book, Can You Hear the Sea? My Grandmother's Story. Brenda Nile, can you describe the box your grandmother gave you when you were 10 years old?
It's a rather unpretentious little box. Wouldn't hold a great deal, would hold perhaps 50 or so letters, maybe more. You could put away precious things in it. You could barely put a penguin book inside it to give an idea of the size. Well, you could put half a dozen of them. But it's a square box and has a lock and key. And that was one of the things that attracted me to it as a 10-year-old, with the appeal of a secret space to put private things in.
And what did you know about its history when you were 10? What did your grandmother tell you about it?
I don't know who told me. It might have been my mother, it might have been my grandmother. But I did know that when my grandmother came to Australia by sailing ship in 1888, it was a long journey, and her brother, who had been ill and was suspected of TB, was coming to Australia for his health, accompanied by his two sisters, my grandmother, the younger one of them. And the two sisters, one did sketching. My grandmother was a great reader of novels. And the brother, I don't know, but he made friends with the carpenter, the ship's carpenter, and he started to make this box to give to my grandmother to keep things in. So as long as I can remember, it was referred to as Uncle Joe's box because he had made it for her, and she'd kept it throughout many times in her life in Australia as something. It was in her bedroom. It was on a chest of drawers. It was something special. I had never seen her open it. It came to me when I was just about 10, a few weeks off my 10th birthday, as a Christmas present, and that was a surprise. I wasn't expecting her to give me that or anybody that. It was part of the furniture, part of her treasures.
Why do you think it came to you, of all the grandchildren?
Well, I've thought about that most recently, I suppose, when I began to think. Well, actually, I began to think, what am I going to do with it? The moment that might have led to her giving it to me was the fact that while she was away on holidays, her flat was broken into, some things were taken, some jewellery was taken, and the box was wrenched open, and the hinges broken, and the lock and key broken. So for some months, so far as I know, it was empty, and there it was. Some impulse made her give it to me on Christmas Eve, 1940. Well, various things have occurred to me. Christmas 1940, when she gave it to me, and just before, was the early years of the war. The war wasn't all that close to Australia. This was well before the Japanese came into it, and it was all rather distant. But for her, having grown up in Liverpool, which was being bombed out of existence, that time must have been traumatic. And somehow the box, which was the last link with Liverpool, the last link with her brother, who died at sea, having just finished the box. So the box had enormous emotional significance for her. And why at age about 70 she decided that she didn't want to keep it any longer and that she would give it to me, I can't be certain, but I think that perhaps our excursions to the films where we saw newsreels of the bombing of Liverpool, the devastation of the city, Churchill's praise of the brave people of Liverpool, and beside her in the Athenaeum Cinema in Collins Street, Melbourne, was me, this 10-year-old who was just enjoying the day out, enjoying the film we were about to see, and looking forward to a milkshake afterwards.
Between her giving you that box and this book that you've written now called Can You Hear the Sea, you've immersed yourself in so many other lives as a biographer. Were you always going to turn to your grandmother's life, do you think?
No, I wasn't. I didn't think of it probably until a few years ago. Biography, as you know, generally turns people to celebrities. And my grandmother was the least of a celebrity that you can imagine. She led a very quiet life. In many ways, it was tempestuous because the big events of the century touched her quite closely, First World War, for example. But she wasn't, as so many subjects of biography are, she was not eccentric. She was a quiet woman. She didn't make any trouble. People didn't notice her very much. She was highly intelligent, but I don't know how much that would have been appreciated. She had been a widow for many years. She was widowed at 39 when my grandfather died very sadly at 43, and she'd concentrated on her children and on her private life. So I never felt that I wouldn't have thought of her as a promising subject for a biography.
So, but as a biographer, I'm wondering if the questions you asked of your grandmother Aggie's life were the same questions you ask in any biography, or if they were different. So what were the questions you wanted to answer?
The big one, I suppose, was how did it feel to find herself stranded in Australia, strange land? Why, after the death of her brother at sea, did she not go home again? She could have. Her parents had survived the Great Famine of Ireland, the 1840s, by migrating to Liverpool, where they had a pretty tough life, really refugees, you'd say. But they made good in Liverpool, and she could have gone back to a comfortable house because their fortunes had improved drastically. My grandfather must have been a very capable man because he'd risen from barefoot boy on the factory floor to foreman, part owner, and owner of a string of factories which his sons inherited.
Now, Brenda, I was surprised by how moved I was by the details of those factories. What were they? What was that industry that was part of her family history?
Well, that surprised me too. I never thought about matches as being anything special. People in my youth were all lighting cigarettes all the time. I found it as moving as Dickens and his blacking factory, and rather like it. The things that I'd read fed into it, I think, and the feeling that someone as close to me as that could have been through those experiences of being cheap child labour in Liverpool, doing shifts at night probably, and doing the light work of matchmaking, as they called it, filling boxes, dipping the wooden matches into the combustible stuff that made them light up.
It was horribly dangerous, wasn't it?
Horribly dangerous. So many got what they call fussy jaw from the red phosphorus. Oh, sorry, the white phosphorus. Red was safer. It was an appalling industry and very cheap labour. And reading the 1862 Royal Commission into the conditions in the factory, this is a period when industrial safety was just waking up, I thought, there's my grandfather. I was so relieved as I kept reading and found that he was one of the ones with the white hat on, that he hadn't been an oppressor. He had actually done his best for industrial safety and for the outlawing of the dangerous phosphorus, and that his sons, one of them, carried through the industrial reform that led to the outlawing of white phosphorus.
So there's a sense in which this quiet woman bringing up a large family and surviving through all sorts of things also didn't always quite fit in some ways. So during the South African War, the Boer War, there was some political resistance there, and one of her sons was a pacifist in World War One. So her political placement, I mean, it's not sort of obvious, but there's something interesting there too, isn't there?
Well, there is, and to take the question of her pacifist son in World War One first, that is quite striking because that's my Uncle Jack, my mother's brother, he was a great reader too. He was very close to his mother after his father's death, and I think they must have talked. Parcels of books came to him, to their property, Galtee Park, often. He would just send for anything in a catalogue he liked the sound of, and I think that they shared it so that his political beliefs would have been something he could have talked about to her, but probably not to anybody else. When he went to school, he found that they were all gung-ho for the war, and he couldn't think that was right. So his independence and thinking, I think it came from her, because they were very close. And how she got that so strongly, I don't know, except that when I found that during the Boer War, she and her husband had been passionately opposed to Australia sending a contingent and thought that the war was wrong and the treatment of civilians was barbarous. My grandfather went to the meetings and he moved motions denouncing the war, and incidentally, coming from a tiny place like Savernack, New South Wales, it's extraordinary that he made the front page of the Times with this little snippet saying that some, I can't think of what word they used, but deplorable people in New South Wales had been saying that the British Army was treating civilians badly. And that was a blasphemous thing to say because, as everybody knew, the British Army was perfect, never did anything wrong. But my grandfather was on record and saying that they certainly did. The naming of their child, the child born in 1900, early in the South African period, he was called Adrian Patrick Joubert. And Joubert was an extraordinary name to take to the baptismal font, because Joubert was the name of the general in the Boer War, on the anti-British side, of course, who made things extremely difficult for the British Army, hold them up, more or less starved them out of a particular position, and would have been much hated. And to go along to the church and say, I want this child baptised, Adrian Patrick Joubert, you'd think the priest would say, Joubert? Who's Joubert? And certainly everybody did. He eventually dropped it. He wasn't known by it anyway. But that was a big statement, as was calling of her older child, Nugent, after a radical priest in Liverpool who had run shelters for the homeless, ragged schools, things like that. So she always had a social conscience, and she passed that on, I think, to her children, partly through books, partly through the freedom to read anything they liked. My mother at 13 was given Anne Veronica by H.E. Wells, which was thought to be quite shocking. It was about the new woman. And yet I don't think grandmother could really be described as a feminist. Well, perhaps she could, I don't know. She certainly didn't join anything. She didn't go anywhere. She was at home reading, thinking, talking, but not a joiner and not a public woman in any sense. Certainly, with seven children born within 15 years, you didn't have a lot of time.
No, not for anything, really. Brenda, we've talked about the role of fiction and the importance of books in both your own life and your grandmother Aggie's life, but where does it fit in the life of a biographer? Because you do take us into the mind of your grandmother at times. Yes. And I wonder how you do that as a biographer, when you decide that you can extend your sort of fictional imagination and when you're sticking quite close to the documents and the traces you found.
Well, it's hard to say, really, because it's so many layered. There are things that I remember, like a discussion with my grandmother about Jane Eyre and Agnes Grey and the role of a governess. And I thought at first, Agnes, she's thinking her own name. But no, she was thinking of the book itself and that it was realism, whereas Jane Eyre, she said, was a fairy tale. Well, a fairy tale ending anyway, but Agnes Grey was more like what it was like to be a governess. I think she must have known them in Liverpool. So we did talk about books. Nearly all these books that my grandmother read and liked, though she criticised some of them perhaps a bit sharply, all of them had a quite different plot from her own life. This struck me a bit later, really, that the pattern for most Victorian novels is to begin with, oh, disaster, your father's lost all his money, and then the girls have to go out to work. Well, with my grandmother, it was the exact opposite. She was happy teaching. She was 18, 19. And when her father said, if things go on as well as they are, my daughters will not have to go out to work. And she could see herself as one of five daughters living in suburbia in Liverpool. They had moved by then to a respectable part of the city. She could see herself, well, just sitting there like one of the Bennett sisters waiting to get married and knowing that the trend of the times, or what was accepted as duty, was that her brothers would take care of her. she would never have anything of her own. Brothers would be good, and they certainly were devoted, came to Australia to see her. They gave her a lot, but she didn't want to be dependent. And when you ask how I thought through it, I kind of remembered these discussions about books like Agnes Grey, dependence on brothers, and the imperative of getting married. She didn't like it. She thought she would come to Australia. When the chance came with the brother who was ill, she took it because she didn't know what she wanted exactly, but she knew that it wasn't being one of the five sisters, close in age, all living together, meant to get married, but if they didn't, they would have the safety valve of knowing their brothers would look after them. And she thought a lot about that, and she made sure when her husband made his will, when he was dying, that the will, quite unusually, gave exactly the same to the daughters, to my mother and her sister, as to the brothers. They didn't go in for that habit of locking up the land to the eldest son, and that was pretty revolutionary, actually.
When you think about the whole process of writing this book and compare it to the other biographies that you've written, was it different?
I thought it'd be easier. It wasn't, actually. I realised afterwards that it has something in common with the others, because all my books, for whatever reason, have been about exile or displacement or something. I wrote a book about the Boyd family, who moved between hemispheres, footloose, and never quite settling anywhere. I wrote about Georgiana McCrae, who came because her husband had financial troubles. She didn't want to come. She's a colonial painter. She came to Australia because she had to.
Well, Mannix turns
Mannix,
up in this
yes,
book.
Yes, Mannix was sent. Mannix was always Irish. His being in Melbourne was because he had to come. He was under obedience, though for somebody as kind of willful as Mannix was, the idea of him coming under obedience sounds a bit funny, but of course he did. It was a promotion, or it was more likely actually to get him out of the way in Ireland because he was a bit of a firebrand. So yes, Mannix didn't want to come here, and really there is no book of mine, except perhaps the Durack sisters, that doesn't deal with displacement from the point of view of the protagonists. And the Duracks, in the Duracks, it was a bit the other way around, in that what was exposed in that book was the displacement of the indigenous people on the properties which the Durack pioneers had settled. So displacement, exile, loneliness is part of all the things I've written. So I suppose I have to ask the question, why did I keep writing about these people who were exiled when my own experience has been so settled, confined, and linked with one part of Melbourne? I thought, is it that I'm looking at the life I didn't lead, could have led, didn't? Or is it, when I began to think about my grandmother, I thought maybe that's where it comes from, that at some level, even as a child, an understanding of what it meant to her to be away from home, particularly during the war, when her family faced the bombing, obliteration perhaps, maybe there was something that I absorbed through those early excursions with her and through my closeness to her that I wasn't aware of. I don't know, but there is a link. They're all a long way from home and they all felt displacement.
Brenda, you've filled that wooden box with so many stories and so many interesting stories. Thank you so much for speaking to us on RN.
Thank you, Kate.
Brenda Niles' Can You Hear the Sea is published by Text, and she was speaking with me. I'm Kate Evans, this is Books Plus, and together we're reading. Plenty of books ahead to share, a new novel from Isabel Allende next week, and I might even dare to play the most difficult interview I did all year with the wonderful writer of Tiny Stories, Joy Williams. She's very sparing with her words. So join me next time. Thank you.